you know, ridiculous birds, four yes. colors, red, blue, green, yellow. It's like, something if you don't know birds, you throw them a picture and you're like, oh, AI, yeah, that's that can't possibly be real.
Right,
so you take them in the field and you're like, nope, see, that's the bird, and just blow their mind.
When I was living in Galveston, I think I had read about it somewhere, heard about it, and thought, oh, you know, I'm never going to see one.
Right.
But then you can't miss it, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just so explosive with color, so... Welcome to the third episode of Desert Diaries. This is Daniel Carey Whalen. I'm the director of the Centennial Museum in Chihuahuan Desert Gardens on the campus of University of Texas at El Paso. I'm with Dr. Kevin Floyd, our botanical curator. How are you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. Excited to talk about some more natural history. This one's one of my favorites, so I'm going to have to control myself a little bit.
Right. I know. Yeah. This week we're talking about birds. So Kevin's a birder. So there are a whole different breed of people here. Good eyes, great binoculars and cameras. But we're going to spend the episode talking about birds of this region, Chihuahuan Desert. What are some of the birds that live year-round in our desert area, and what makes them unique?
So we've got a surprising amount of birds in El Paso. I think there have been over 400 species of birds recorded in El Paso County over the years.
Wow.
Including some weird ones, like someone saw a flamingo out in the northeast once.
Wow.
No one knows, you know, where it... Probably a zoo release or something
that.
Yeah. But there's always, you know, interesting things that come through. But a lot of our residents, there's things like, you know, the roadrunner, of course, is one of the classic birds that's here year-round.
Yeah.
There's desert cardinal, which is called Pyraluxia, which is a really cool bird that most people don't necessarily recognize, but it has that same cardinal shape. And, of course, cardinals, because they're so widespread throughout North America, through the U.S., like that's the bird you see on the packaging. That's the bird you see on. So it's a gray bird with some red highlights in the male.
Okay.
Has the same crest, has the big bill for eating seeds. That's a really amazing bird to see. But a lot of the birds here, so, you know, you think about the desert, they have to be able to survive in these conditions. And, you know, birds need all the things all living creatures need. They need water, they need food, they need shelter. You know, water is probably one of the big ones, but a lot of the birds are able to get all the water they need just from the food that they eat. And so you may have seen, especially in the spring, the green buds on trees, and the birds are actually there like picking the buds, because those buds have more moisture content than like seeds do and leaves and some of the other things. So they get a lot of the moisture sort of while they're also getting the food.
Okay. Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah.
And then they're really good at conserving water. You know, we all have had, you know, bird poop on our windshields, and that white, the white stuff's basically their form of urine, and they're able to concentrate it further than we are because it's a different chemical. And that's also why it sticks to your car so well, is that it's not as soluble in water. And so it really can stick on there.
Good. I didn't know we were going to be talking about bird poop today.
any biologist is happy to talk poop in any situation.
Right,
so
true,
it's just something we enjoy.
Yeah.
And so the birds, you know, they're year-round birds, all sorts of different shapes, colors. Depending on what part of town you're in, they can be different as well. So if you're down by the river, you're going to see, you know, different birds than if you're up in the mountains. You know, we have red-tailed hawks basically year-round, Cooper's hawks year-round. Doves are good friends we were talking about before we started recording. The white-winged dove is the real sort of probably the most common in the city.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, those numbers have increased a lot. That's a story where the white-winged doves are actually expanding their range in North America.
Only all over El Paso.
Yeah, and not that, you know, maybe a few decades ago, they were unusual to see here.
Wow.
And they've just been spreading further north. And now, you know, the people in Montana get super excited when they see a white-winged dove, because that's a new bird for them to see in their state. You know, they're really, you know, they're pretty birds. I think, you know, a lot of times birds that we think of sort of as pest birds, you know, the things that are around all the time that are pooping on your yard, you know, eating stuff off your patio. Yeah. We tend to not look at them very carefully, but, you know, white-winged doves have a really pretty blue skin around their eye. They've got, you know, the white wings that are part of their mating display, actually. Like, I don't know if you look, they do almost like a karate kick or a karate move, and they stick their arm, like their wings, straight up in the air. Wow. And that white bar that's on it basically is highlighted at that point. And so you can see two of them sort of standing, you know, doing a face-off, both of them with their wings up in the air, which is, you know, when you don't know what's going on, you're like, what's going on here? But yeah, they're territorial display, a dominance display. Yeah. Whoever has the most impressive wing bar is the winner.
Nice. Wow. Okay. I did not know that. I mean, I see them. They're in my backyard. There's a power line behind me. They're always hanging out on that. I think they're beautiful when they fly. They mm-hmm. you know, you can see that white bar. It's pretty, striking, and even in the distance. But I didn't know it was because of a mating.
And the other one I just have to tell you about is the great-tailed grackle, which is another bird that people think of as annoying because they're pretty ubiquitous and they can get into parking lots and things like that. They're, you know, pretty large black birds with long tails. A lot of people, if they, you know, don't know birds very well, they'll say they're crows because most people think a big black bird is a crow. And we do have crows, but they're winter birds for us. But year-round, it's the grackles. And the males do, again, it's sort of a territorial display where they'll all get together and sit with their necks straight up. And so they're all kind of like staring into space. Yeah. And you'll see a couple of them next to each other. And that's how they, you know, are displaying amongst each other. Beautiful, like iridescent black body. And then if they're actually find a female, they chase the female around with this weird, like they kind of puff up and hunch over and like flutter their wings and weird noises.
The noises are surreal. I moved to Texas and I'm from Kansas originally. I don't think they have grackles up there because I was like, what the heck is that noise?
Right. It's almost like weird alien electronic clicks and stuff. So, but yeah, it just, you know, whenever we're talking birds, of course, we like to focus on, you know, the most colorful or the most unusual. But I think there really is a lot to see with the ones that are everywhere, and just not to overlook them. And once you start thinking about the behavior and what they're doing and just, and they're beautiful as well, just a different, you know, a different color, sort of that shiny black instead of, you know, bright red or bright blue.
Well, but it almost, you know, in the sunlight, I think it's almost got like a purple color sometimes, and it's really kind of shiny. I mean, they're a beautiful bird to look at because it's not just a straight flat black. I mean, it's really iridescent.
Yeah.
So, okay, nice. And they're here year round. I knew that, though I should have. I was just eating out at a local eating establishment. There were tons of them in a tree, and we were sitting outside, and we're like, nope, we're going to go inside because they were just going crazy.
You make the mistake sometimes of like getting that shady parking spot that everyone abandoned or doesn't park in, and it's like, oh, that's full of birds, and back to bird poop.
Okay, so we talked about birds who live here, and some of these birds may live here year round. But I know there's also these type of birds that migrate here. But when people visit the Centennial Museum, they're always surprised when they go upstairs to the third floor of the biology gallery. We have a very large display of waterfowl in our biology gallery. And people always say, you know, we live in the desert. How can these birds live in the desert? You know, what do you say to those people who see that? I mean, I don't think all the birds on that wall are in the Chihuahuan Desert, but it's all but like one or two from my memory.
I think pretty much all of them have been reported at some point. So they might be the ones that, you know, they're mostly found someplace else, but occasionally come into our area, like the flamingo, right? It's something that isn't normally here, but was here once or twice. And those are more, there's some of the sea ducks, the scoters that are up there but even just this year, somebody found, you know, six of them in a pond. I forget where exactly in town, but there's always weird things, you know. That's the thing with birds. It's cool. They fly. And so they can show up in places that that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, right. But
yeah, we have a lot of waterfowl. So, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people have learned is, you know, birds fly south for the winter, right?
Right.
Like we've all learned that. And here we're south. Like we are the south for the winter for a lot of these species. So a lot of ducks, they breed up in Canada and in sort of the Great Plains in that area. They reproduce up there and then they fly south to where it's warmer and where they can, where basically where water isn't frozen over solid, because that's the thing. They need to be able to forage in water for a lot of them. And it doesn't typically freeze over here. You know, we might get some ice on a pond, but it usually doesn't freeze solid, and it definitely doesn't last for more than a couple days.
Right.
And some birds keep going further south, but you know, this some get here and say that's good enough, and they'll stay in this area. And so, you know, if you go to some of the wetlands in town, probably one of the best spots is Rio Bosque Wetlands Park, which is a city property now, but managed by UTEP for almost 25 years now, I think, or longer, from the 90s.
Right.
And they flood wetland cells and have a ton of great duck diversity. I think sometimes in good winters, there's a couple thousand ducks there, and just about every species, there's probably, you know, a good dozen species of ducks that you can find in that area.
Wow.
And yeah, so you don't think about it necessarily, but, you know, we've got all these other pockets of habitat, and there is, you know, there's a river that runs through town. So, you know, historically we've had, you know, wetlands associated with the river and springs and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think of how many, you know, it was probably a lot more in the past when the Rio Grande flooded its banks, and before damming the river, that there were wetlands and oxbows, and that these were just perfect little riparian wetland areas for waterfowl to hang out in.
Yeah.
So that's obviously decreased a lot because of damming the river and other development. But there's still enough wetlands and water places, Escarte Lake, there's places for them to hang out in here.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say enough, right? Like there probably were more in the past. But one of the really cool things with ducks is that they're a really great conservation story, and it's due in large part to the fact that people like to hunt them. And so, you know, Ducks Unlimited and some of the other groups that are really focused on waterfowl conservation, to have enough population to be able to hunt sustainably, they've put a ton of resources into protecting and restoring wetlands. And Rio Bosque, actually, Ducks Unlimited, was part of the group that was involved in the design and the preservation and restoration of it as a wetland.
Right.
And so, you know, and when you look, you know, the sad thing when you look at birds is, you know, across the board, they're not doing well. The population numbers are decreasing.
Right.
But the one sort of counter to all of that are the waterfowl, and that those populations have been increasing while everything else has been going down. And a lot of that is because you protect the habitat. We know what habitat they like. They like wetlands, and we can protect that. Okay. And shockingly, when you protect the home, the birds do better.
Yeah, right. No, it's an amazing conservation story, and such a, you know, hunters, environmentalists, you know, it takes a whole bunch of people from all walks of life, I think, to make these happen. And we learned a lot about that, of course, in our A Waddle Through Time exhibit. So it's actually no longer at the Centennial Museum, but it's on our website. You can see the exhibit A Waddle Through Time, which is about the human-duck relationship, and it features some of the research of Dr. Phil Lavretsky, who's a professor here in the biology department. And I learned a lot about ducks and waterfowl, and he has a great project called Duck DNA that he's been doing for a while. But I love those conservation stories of that it takes, you know, it's people that you normally don't, especially in kind of the, you know, divided society. It's like hunters and environmentalists or ranchers and environmentalists, but they actually have more in common than the politics would lead you to believe. So,
yeah. And a lot of times, you know, I think most people would like to protect nature, and it's just,
right,
can we, you know, make it easy enough for them to do it while they can also, you know, meet the other needs that they have. So even talking ranchers, there's a lot of programs now. Grassland birds are one that have been having a really serious decline, and particularly in the Chihuahuan Desert, we have a lot of or had a lot of grasslands that have been degraded through cattle ranching primarily. Right. And so those birds don't have winter habitat. And there are, you know, there's programs out there with National Audubon, with Texas A&M and some others that are trying to help the ranchers manage their ranch in a way that's also beneficial for the birds.
Nice.
And in some cases, it's not that difficult to do. It's a timing of, you know, when do you actually, you know, plow the field? When do you, you know, cut the hay? How many cows do you put on a particular field? Yeah. Or how do you maintain those watering holes for the cows? And there's actually programs called, I think it's a couple ranches have bird friendly or bird certified beef. And so people, I don't know if any of them are available locally, but I know there's a couple ranches in, I think in New Mexico and in Texas that are part of that program where, you know, they're managing their ranch in a way that helps birds and they get to, you know, slap that label on there so consumers can, you know, try to support the people who are doing it the right way.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
I'll have to look out for it.
Yeah.
Next time, I know you are a vegetarian.
Yeah.
But next time, I'm looking for a hamburger. we kind of talked about some of these waterfowl being migratory, but what are some of the other migratory species that a person can see in the area?
So probably the stuff that people get most excited about is spring migration.
Sure.
And so part of it is it's spring. So we're coming out of winter and there's new birds coming through. But also a lot of the birds that come through are really, really pretty. So a lot of the warblers, which are, you know, small little birds, they tend to have, you know, most are yellow with other sorts of patterns, but they migrate through. They winter in, you know, Central America, some as far as South America. And then they come through and it sort of adds that cheery, you know, yellow bird in your yard or in a park. And then they keep going, which I think also makes it interesting. There are birds that, you know, we're not the end destination for them. We're a pass through.
Right.
And so that's always exciting. And then they come back through in the fall and then it's exciting all over again to see what comes through.
Yeah.
But then there's also a lot of our summer birds that people get excited by that migrate in just for the summer are things like painted buntings, which you know, ridiculous birds, four colors, red, blue, green, yellow, I think I missed. And the males are just gorgeous. And we're at the extent of the far side of their range. So we don't get them in as big as numbers. They sort of go through, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, or in that area more. And so we get the stragglers out at the side. But they are just gorgeous birds. Like that, it's something if you don't know birds, you show them a picture and you're like, oh, AI. Yeah, that's that can't possibly be real.
Right.
So you take them in the field and you're like, nope, see, that's the bird. And
just
blow their mind.
Well, you know, I've said I'm kind of a novice birder and the painted bunting is on my list of birds I've seen. And when I was living in Galveston, I had the pleasure of seeing one and just, you know, so exhilarating. I mean, they're so beautiful and colorful. I think I'd read about it somewhere, heard about it, and thought, oh, you know, I'm never going to see one. But then you can't miss it, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just so explosive with color. So, well, someone was just asking me this at the museum the other day of when is spring migration and how long are most of the birds here? I know it varies, but.
Yeah, so it depends on the group. So things like shorebirds, like sandpipers and things like that, they tend to move through a little earlier in the spring. And so that's like March, April.
Okay.
The warblers are more April, May. Painted buntings show up typically May. And because they summer here, they're here typically until the males leave maybe August-ish, and then the females or the immatures, which some birds, the males and females look very different. And then the young of the year, the immatures, look like the females. And so in the fall, it can be really tricky because you've got females, which are usually drab, and the immatures, which are usually drab. And so there's several species that all look very similar. And you're trying to figure out, is that a greenish brown or a brownish green?
right.
It definitely gives you the challenge of bird identification.
Yeah.
And then, so those are sort of the spring piece. So roughly, you know, March, April, May is the peak for spring migration, depending on the group. And then some stuff, the shorebirds, again, they come down early. Like you will start seeing them migrate through in, you know, end of June, July. So, and again, it's mostly the males because they make it up north, reproduce, and then they are like, good. I'm good. I'm out of here. And they turn around and head back south. Then the fall migration, I mean, it can go from that sort of late summer all the way through, you know, October. Like things start to quiet down, you know, kind of October-ish. But even still, like you'll see, you know, unusual things. I just saw at the museum, you know, I think it was a summer tanager or something, which is not a bird that's usually here this late. But, you know, for whatever reason, it was behind the rest of the crew. Someone's always got to be the last one, right?
That's right. Don't forget to turn the lights off, right? Well, in migration reminds me, I've become keenly aware of this at the museum, mainly because we have a large window, but also at my house we have, you know, large windows, east facing windows. But I feel like I know spring migration, or I know, well, this fall was bad. There's lots of bird strikes on the windows, and I feel like, okay, yeah, it's why are there so many happening? And then you remind me, okay, wait, it's migration season. So it seems like that's one of the pitfalls of the Chihuahuan Desert Garden being right next to the museum, is the birds are coming to the garden because it's so lush and it's this great oasis, but then they fly out and hit this huge window because it looks like the sky, right?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the windows, it's reflective. And so, you know, birds see a reflection and it looks like habitat or it looks like the sky. And, you know, they didn't evolve with glass to understand how all this works. And so a lot of times they'll just fly, you know, full speed directly into a window. Yeah. And it's one of the big causes of declines, I'm sure globally. And there's programs now that are trying to counter that. And so it can be as simple as lights out. There's lights out campaigns in the spring and fall. And, you know, if you turn off the lights on the inside, basically you turn off the lights and then you're not getting that reflection anymore. And so the birds are less likely to strike the window.
Yeah.
And then there's treatments you can put on it. So there's decals. And I think a lot of us have probably seen like the single silhouette of a hawk in the middle of a window at a nature center. And unfortunately, those don't work. The birds are like, oh, I'll just fly to the left of that and then hit the window. So.
Not scared of it. Oh, no, wait, there's a hawk.
Right. It's like this black thing that isn't moving and looks vaguely like a hawk. Oh, no. So now the idea is that they have to be, you know, you need to have a pretty good grid or set of lines, and they need to be, you know, about 2 inches apart. And there's some that are, you know, highly visible to both us and birds, but birds can see more into the ultraviolet range. And so there's some that are very reflective in the ultraviolet and show up sort of transparent to us. And I was just looking at the Franklin Mountains State Park, their headquarters, which is only a couple years old now. They also had beautiful glass windows so you could see the mountains, and they were getting a lot of window strikes. Just in the last year or so, they've done window treatments on all of them. And I was talking with the rangers and they said it was a big difference that they were getting, you know, one or two a day during migration of birds hitting the windows. And now they don't. Because also they have a water feature, they've got good habitat. Right. So it's all the things that we want to bring birds in.
Right.
And then we're like, and don't fly into that giant thing next to it.
Yeah. Well, I know that we talk about it with facilities folks here, and that they're trying to do things to also minimize those bird strikes. So I know there's things that can be done. And well, so what are some of the unusual or rare birds in El Paso? I mean, I know you mentioned some, you know, the painted bunting, but is there any kind of, you know, the flamingo obviously is just crazy, but like maybe a rare one that people could see, but it's just kind of unusual.
Yeah. So probably the best example for that is we get every few years there's what's called a montane eruption. And so montane for mountains. And so what happens is a lot of the birds that are found in the mountains, so for us, the Sacramentos, the Gila, we think it's either because they had a really good year and there's so many babies that there's just so many birds that they disperse down out of the mountains and end up in El Paso. Or what's been happening sometimes is there would be a fire or a drought, and so the conditions aren't good in the mountains, and so they migrate down to find something find better habitat. Uh-huh. And just a couple years ago, we had a really amazing, you know, montane eruption. And there is a bird. This is the joy of bird watching. It's a bird called the juniper titmouse, and it's a little gray bird, all gray, like nothing else, with a little black eye and a gray crest. And you show it to somebody, and they would just say, like, what is the point of this? This is the most boring bird I've ever seen. Uh-huh. But it's not supposed to be in El Paso. And so all of us birders were super excited when people started finding them. And they were here on campus. They were in the Franklins. They were in the parks. Like, it was just a ridiculous year where it went from none of them to, you know, 20 or 30 of them seen throughout town. Yeah. And at that same time, there were other birds, like someone saw pinion jays, which are found further north. Sure, and again, occasionally seen, right? Like, it's not something at the level of, you know, flamingo, but it's a bird that it's an every decade occasion, maybe. And it just depends on those conditions. Stellar's jays, which, again, if you've been up to Cloudcroft, you probably have seen them.
I love them. They're Mohawk.
Yeah, Mohawk. They've got, like, black eyeliner. Yeah. Like, they're really, really pretty birds.
Punk rocker.
Yeah.
Of birds.
And, you know, I've lived in El Paso, you know, almost 20 years, and there have been maybe two winters that we've had good numbers of them in town. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it happens, but it's definitely not something that's a very common occurrence.
Yeah.
But it just shows you why you should be looking outside, because you never know what you're going to see. There can be really interesting birds. And a lot of it, again, if you're not a hardcore bird watcher, you may not know what it is, but, one of the things we really encourage people to do, or I encourage people to do, is just look at the birds in your yard. And it doesn't matter if you know them or not. You don't have to, or know their names, but you can start seeing what's there. And then if you see something that you're not used to seeing, then that's something different. That's something cool. And if you snap a picture, you can share it with, you know, El Paso Audubon, which is a bird, nonprofit bird conservation group. We have a Facebook group, and you can share pictures and people can help identify those. But yeah, it's really just becoming familiar with what's in your area. Again, not saying you need to pull out a bird guide and identify everything and figure out the brownish green versus the greenish brown. But when you start appreciating them and seeing how they behave and what they're doing, then you can also start to pick up on those different birds that show up.
Well, yeah, that's what I think I've said it in the last episode or the first episode is I love about birding is that it's so accessible. You know, you can see wild animals in your backyard, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are not tamed creatures. These are, you know, part of nature, and it's right at our fingertips. And I love that accessibility. And you know, as you know, I'm an Audubon member as well, so I kind of keep up on it. I definitely love reading about birds, and it kind of goes into, you know, one of my next question of bird-human relationships. You know, how can we live in harmony? And it reminds me of this great article I read, and Audubon, you probably read it too, of how social media is transforming birding, and that there's, these, I think it was like a bird in New York City, like Central Park. Someone saw this rare bird, they posted it, and all these people are running to see it. But then kind of the ethics of these posters, right, that people have these sites that are, you know, how to see these rare, rare birds, and people are going to kind of great lengths, including destroying habitat.
Right.
how do we ensure the balance between, the area's birds and humans? How can we live in harmony?
Obviously there's a lot we can do. If I guess the first thing is don't be a jerk and crash over habitat to go see a rare bird. And a lot of times, you know, especially if it's something like an owl that, you know, roosts during the daytime and, you know, flies around at night, if people know where that roost is, then it makes it pretty easy to go find. And so, you know, birders tend to be pretty careful about who they tell, you know, location of owls and things like that, because, you know, we don't want to, you know, love the birds to death. death. We don't want to go to a place and get too close. And I mean, the temptation is there. Like, I fight it every time I'm looking for something of like, if I just get two more steps closer, then I'll get that branch out of the way. So there is a lot of ethics around it. And, you know, we all have to, you know, basically treat the birds with respect and not, you know, get too close to them, not try to disturb them in any way. So that's sort of like on an individual case, but we can be doing a lot in our own yards. So that's one of the things we really promote at the Chuan Desert Gardens is using your home landscape as a way to create bird-friendly habitat. Yeah. And of course, a lot of that starts with native plants. So the plants that, you know, either are producing the seeds and the fruits that the birds like, or they're the food for the insects that then the birds eat. And a lot of birds, almost every bird eats insects at some part of their life. Even hummingbirds that we never think about as being insect eaters, they're catching gnats and things both for themselves, but especially for their babies when they're raising young. And so if you have a yard that's been blasted, you know, that doesn't support insects because it's either the wrong type of plants or because you're using pesticides, there's no food for the babies. And so that's going to impact the population going forward. So the more we can do in our house to really, you know, or in our yards to provide good habitat. And then once you have that habitat, you got to keep it safe. So like we were talking about with windows, that's a big piece, trying to, you know, make sure that any of the big windows in particular are covered. There's also stuff about how close the feeders, if you do feed birds, you know, either pretty close to the window so they don't have enough, they can't get enough momentum when they crash into it. Yeah. So they just kind of bounce off, or very far away so that they have a greater chance to see the window and move out of the way or the stuff around it. But cats are another one. So
we all
love cats. I've got three cats myself. But cats kill birds and mammals. Yeah. And so, you know, if you have cats, you can give them. We have a giant clown collar for the cat that we let outside. So we let her outside when we're at home, and she has to wear her clown collar. And it does. It's multicolored. It's got a reflective ring. Yeah, and it's something that makes her more visible. So the birds, you know, they instead of, you know, the stealthy, and it's so funny to watch her because she's like crouched behind something, and she thinks she's being very stealthy, but then there's this like multicolored, you know, clown collar sticking out from behind the bush. And it makes a big difference. You know, it keeps the birds from, you know, getting eaten by those cats.
Yeah.
Or keep cats inside, of course. That's always the recommendation, not just for wildlife, but cats that are inside live longer. I think they're not going to get hit by a car. Exactly. They're not going to get eaten by a coyote. Like, there's just so much that's better for them. Or if you want them outside and you want to go crazy, build a catio. Like, that's definitely a dream of ours, right? Like, having an enclosed place that they can be safely outside, enjoy all the fun smells and stuff, but not actually be in, either be harm themselves or cause harm to other other critters.
It's probably all coming from Audubon magazine. I know the catio was an article in there, but also just how devastating, you know, cats especially have been to so many species throughout the world, right? You know, they kind of come with humans wherever humans go, and then they kill a lot of things because they're hunters.
It's
right?
what
they're
predators, do,
right?
I mean,
exactly.
And you can't really breed, or we haven't bred that out of them yet. I don't know if that's ever possible, but and there have been studies where people put little cameras on collars because a lot of people will say, you know, my cat never kills anything. I mean, of course, there's people that's like, oh yeah, my cat brought me another present, right? They left another mouse on the doorstep.
Well, just an organ or something.
There's a head now, but they put cameras on them, and even stuff that the owners thought would never kill an animal, they're out killing animals. It's just kind of what they do. So like I said, I'm a cat lover, but we have to, you know, take care of them. I'm also a bird lover. So we've got to deal with both responsibly.
Yes. No, I live with two cats, and one of our methods is, well, at least one of them, he's so fat he couldn't chase anything. So we just overfeed him, and he won't kill anything.
I think my wife's a veterinarian, so I don't think that is not the recommended approach, it is an option. Our cat's three-legged, so, and again, it wasn't done for that purpose, but it does slow her down a bit.
Right, yeah. Well, where you've already mentioned, you know, Rio Bosque, but where are some of the places that we can find birds in the El Paso area?
So, I mean, come to UTEP. So that's a great place. We've got a lot of really, really great birds on campus, particularly in the gardens, because we do have, you know, a lot of the food sources for them with the native plants.
Right.
But that's a great place for them. I, of course, you know, your backyard, a lot of people, you don't have to go very far to see birds. If you are looking to, you know, check out some other places, Rio Bosque that we mentioned is a great one. Escarate is another wonderful place. And Escarate I really like for beginners because the birds are very accustomed to people.
Right.
And so, you know, the same species that would fly off, you know, when you get within, you know, 300 feet at Rio Bosque, you can basically walk right up to that bird.
Yeah.
And it's probably because they're being fed, which we also do not encourage because bread is very, very bad for waterfowl, but it is a place where you can get pretty close to some of the birds and see them really, really well. Keystone Wetlands and Botanical Garden is another great place.
In the Upper Valley.
Some of the area, the Franklins, of course, is good. There's a bird blind there where they have some feeders and some water, a water feature for them. And then obviously hiking into the mountains themselves can be really good. Waco Tanks. I mean, there's just a lot of any park you go to. That's another great thing with birds is that they're pretty much everywhere. And so it depends on which type you're looking for. But there's a lot of great places in and around town.
I remember, I don't know, it was a couple of weeks ago. I feel like I said, "What did you do this weekend, Kevin?" And you said, "Oh, I was hanging out at the Fred Hervey Water Treatment Plant."
Yeah, it's funny. So you know, sewage treatment plants are great birding spots and garbage dumps too. And again, like a lot of the way the wastewater treatment works is there's ponds, there's settling ponds.
Sure,
and so you bring in water, you've got better birds. So, if you're too close to the plant, the smell's not great. But there's some really, although I feel like you just kind of get used to it.
So all those folks working up there.
Yeah.
Getting used to it.
Yeah. So it's, you don't always go to the most attractive places, but you also do go to a lot of the attractive places. So you go to all the places.
Yeah. I know we could keep talking for a while, but any other bird you want to plug or?
I would just say, you know, I think people, there does seem to be a swell of interest in birds. I think COVID and people staying at home got into that as well, kind of like with gardening. But I think there's this idea that you have to be able to identify birds. You have to have expensive binoculars. You have to have a big camera to be a bird watcher because that's a lot of what people see. If you go to a place, you see, and I'm guilty of that. I've got my binoculars and my big camera, but that's not a requirement by any means. People can, you know, you don't need binoculars. You don't need anything. You can just go look at the birds and appreciate them. And then if you do decide that you want to start doing more, you know, so Audubon Society does field trips and we usually have, you know, binoculars for people to borrow. So we help sort of show people how to use them and what to do. And if you decide that is the best thing in the world, like I have decided, then you can get binoculars. And there's good sets that are, you know, $75 to $100. So it's pricey, but it's not the $4,000 binoculars that the experts use.
Right.
And there's cool, you know, we used to say get a field guide, a paper field guide, and that's still a great idea. They're really nice to flip through, but there's apps now that are free. One of the ones I like to recommend is called Merlin through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It's free. It has picture guide. It also, the feature people love about it now is it does sound ID. You heard
a mine's used it before.
You hear a bird calling and you can, you know, open it up and it starts, you know, it uses the microphone and it tries to match up the sound with ones in the database, and it's surprisingly good. It's not 100%.
Right,
I mean, none of those are going to be, but it is surprisingly good and free. And so somebody can just, you know, get the app, go outside, have a cup of coffee, see what it detects. If it's something, you know, that you don't necessarily match up visually, then I wouldn't say that it's guaranteed that that bird is in your yard. But but it's a cool way to start learning some of the calls and just, again, see what's actually out there.
Yeah.
And then you can certainly keep going up from there. So then, you know, field guides and trips and, you know, Audubon does trips up to Bosque del Apache in New Mexico as an overnight. But then there's also trips to Colombia and Africa and all sorts of cool places. So
next thing you know, you'll be doing a big year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely more for retirees, although there's people that do it that are not. But, yeah, I think anytime I think I'm too hardcore, I remember big year people, and I'm like, I'm pretty well adjusted.
Well, as always, Kevin, such a pleasure to talk with you, and I think we're going to wrap up our third edition of Desert Diaries. I look forward to everyone joining us to celebrate life in the Chihuahuan Desert. See you next time on Desert Diaries.
Desert Diaries is recorded in the KTEP Public Media Studios and is a production of the University of Texas at El Paso Division of Marketing and Communications. Host is Daniel Carey Whalen, producer is Charles Fench, engineering by Paul Castro.
We're bringing the vibes.